This is the Feminine Podcast, the official podcast of Feminine, discussing all things femme, a little bit of EM, and everything in between. I'm Jenny Beck Esme, editor-in-chief of Feminine. I'm really excited to bring you today's Fix 18 content. This is a very timely subject that we really need to think about in our country and kind of in our entire world. And this was a duet by Dr. Megan Rainey and Dr. Tori McGowan. It's called In Our Sights, A Path Forward on Gun Violence. And these two feminems looked at the problem of gun violence in our country from two very different perspectives and gave us just a really compelling way to talk about this argument moving forward. Megan Rainey is a former Peace Corps volunteer and a practicing emergency medicine physician, a federally funded researcher, and a mom of two kids and a bunch of animals. She also is the chief research officer and co-founder of AFFIRM, the American Foundation for Firearm Injury Reduction in Medicine. And AFFIRM's mission is to fill the federal funding gap on gun violence research in order to stop shooters before they shoot. And Dr. Tori McGowan is also an emergency physician, and she's an Air Force veteran. She's been deployed in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and she currently lives and works as an emergency physician in Central Oregon, where she's also the emergency physician for the Oregon Air National Guard CBRNE Enhanced Force Response Package. She lives on a hay farm with her husband, her kids, and her bunch of animals as well, and the two have kind of different perspectives on the issue of gun violence and how we can get to solutions. I urge you to listen to this and use some talking points from this to talk with your friends and family about this important topic. Enjoy.
So welcome to In Our Sights, A Path Forward on Gun Violence.
My name is Tori McGowan, and I'm an ER doc, I'm a veteran, and I'm a mom. When I get in a room like this, I often get the question, how can you own a gun? As you just pointed out, my life is kind of dangerous. And when I'm here in the middle of New York City, I'll give you, that's a fair question. They don't seem to make as much sense here. But I'd like to share with you a story about my dad. My dad still lives in the small town where I grew up. He's been the town dentist since 1971. He retired about 2 years ago, and about a year ago, he was at the post office, and he was confronted by a former patient. This man was mentally ill. My dad took one tooth out of him in 2008. This man came up to my dad and he started screaming at him, "You made all of my teeth fall out and I'm gonna knock you down and I'm gonna stomp on your face so you know what it feels like to lose all of your teeth." My dad was terrified, of course, and he tried to get away and he did exactly what we tell him to do. He called 911. The dispatcher said, "The nearest officer is an hour and a half away and is on a call he can't leave. You're on your own." Think about that. You call 911 and you're told that there is no help coming. Unfortunately, that's a reality for a lot of people that live in rural areas. And all of a sudden, when you think about help not coming, guns and gun owners maybe seem a little less unreasonable.
So I'm Megan. Like Tori, I'm a mom and an emergency physician. I'm also a violence prevention researcher. And for the first 5 years or so of my career, I didn't talk a lot about guns. There were two reasons. The first is that I thought that gun violence was just part of a larger spectrum of violence prevention. And if I talked about stopping violence in general, I didn't have to talk specifically about guns. The second and bigger reason was because I was told over and over again by my valued mentors that I couldn't talk about guns or I'd be endangering my entire career as a federally funded researcher. My willingness to follow those precepts changed for a couple of reasons. The first was a clinical case. It was July, soon after I became an attending. I was working in our trauma rooms at Brown, and a call came over the radio from EMS. GSW, trauma code blue, ETA 2 minutes. We prepared the room, we thought we knew what was going to be coming in, and what rolled in was actually something entirely different. It was a young man who had shot himself in the head. And it turned out that he had done it with his father's gun. His father was a local law enforcement officer. He'd had his gun locked up, but the kid knew where the key to the gun safe was. We didn't save that kid. His loss of life was no more tragic and no more preventable than that of all of the other lives lost that July to gunshot wounds. But what stuck with me about it was that it was so different. I had never before and have never since seen a suicide attempt in my emergency department due to a gun. And the reason why is because guns are different. A suicide attempt with a gun is 90% likely to be fatal. And similarly, assaults with guns are more likely to be fatal. We need to talk about gun violence as something different. The other thing that changed my willingness to talk about guns as something different was Sandy Hook. Like many of us, I will never forget sitting and starting to watch the story come across my newsfeed. I remember watching the pictures of those little kids and their teachers running out of Sandy Hook. And then worse was watching the pictures of the parents whose kids didn't make it. And sitting there watching that as I was preparing for my daughter's birthday party, I decided that I was done being silent and that I had to do something. Clearly, Tori and I come from different perspectives on this issue, but in our own way, we're both warriors for a path forward on gun violence. What we're going to ask of all of you is that for the next 20 minutes or so, you park your preconceptions about what you think gun violence prevention consists of, and you join us in taking down some common myths that prevent us as a country from moving forward.
So as we start this conversation, we all want to be on the same page with a few statistics. Did you know that there are 330 million guns in circulation in the United States?
There were about 40,000 deaths and about 110,000 injuries due to firearms last year.
The FBI estimates that every year in the United States, a gun is used 500,000 times to prevent a violent crime.
There are about 30 million people who hunt each year in the United States and another 10 million who participate in shooting sports.
60% of deaths from guns are suicides.
And about half of those are drunk when they die.
One of the most amazing statistics is that there has been almost no federal funding for gun violence injury prevention since 1996.
And because of that, while we've decreased the death rate from car crashes by over 50% over the last 50 years, we have made no movement on the death rate from guns.
Let's talk about some myths. This is what we see in the news. And unfortunately, the most extreme voices are the ones that get the most airtime. We like to paint guns as either all good or all bad. We've talked about some of the ways that they are harmful and that we see injuries in the emergency room. But I also live with people who depend on them for subsistence hunting. This is how they feed their families. Let's do a little exercise here with me. Take a look at the guns up here. Everybody has to choose one. There's no choosing both. Okay? Let me see a show of hands for the gun on the left. If we have to ban a gun, which one do you want to ban? Let me see the gun on the left. How about the gun on the right? Very few hands. The gun on the left is an AR-15. That stands for Armalite Rifle. That's the manufacturer, not assault rifle. This gun is responsible for less than 1% of all gun deaths in the United States every year. But this is the one that looks scary. And this is the one we have a visceral reaction to. The gun on the right is a handgun. 80% of homicides are committed with a handgun, and the vast majority of suicides as well. One looks scary, one does not, but one is much more dangerous statistically than the other.
The next myth that we want to take on is the myth that all gun owners are good or all gun owners are bad. I'll be honest, when I started working in gun violence prevention, I actually thought this way. I thought, my God, who could be so stupid as to own a gun? Then I started working and talking, and I realized that actually most people who own a gun are really good, smart people, like the lovely Tori standing up here with me. And there are some really, really bad people who don't own guns. When we try to talk about gun ownership as the thing that divides people into good or bad, we're missing the point. We're shutting down conversation because we're labeling a whole swath of the population and making them afraid to engage in conversation. We're also missing much of injury prevention, right? We don't label car owners as good or bad. What we do is we talk about moments when maybe people should or shouldn't be driving a car. So going back to that thing I talked about before where we've decreased car crash deaths by 50%, we did that by saying, hey, people with uncontrolled seizures, you can't drive a car until your seizures are under control. Or, hey, people who have progressive dementia, maybe their doctors or their family should have a talk with them about when it's time to take away the keys. Or, you know, you've had a little bit too much to drink tonight. We don't say you can never drive a car again unless they mess up over and over. What we say is find a designated driver. Don't drive tonight, right? And so here I would challenge us to not think about gun ownership as the thing that is good or bad, but rather about certain people being safe to own a gun at one point or another.
The next myth that gets a lot of airtime in the news is if we just had more laws, we could fix this, right? We could legislate our way out of this. The other side says, we don't need more laws. The Brookings Institute put out a report in 2008, and they estimate that there are about 300 laws at the state and federal level that are relevant to our discussion today. And if 300 laws haven't fixed it, will 305? People on both sides of the debate can agree on a few things. If a law isn't enforced, it's not useful. And if a law doesn't address the base issues in the problem, it's not going to be helpful either. One law that gets a lot of airtime goes back to the picture that I showed, the assault rifle ban. That's a really popular one to bring back. But the Department of Justice themselves say that a ban on assault rifles is likely to have little or no impact on gun violence deaths. On the other hand, laws that make it so that a domestic violence perpetrator cannot own a gun in a state results in a 4 times decreased rate of homicide in the spouse in the future. That's a law that most of us can get behind. But what we need is more research so that we can understand what interventions work and which ones don't.
Which leads into the next myth, that gun owners hate research, or that research is just a code word for gun control. So I'm going to take it back a step here. I mentioned at the beginning of the talk that I had been very explicitly told not to do research on guns. The reason why is because in 1996, after a groundbreaking study by one of our own, Art Kellerman, that showed that homes with a gun had higher rates of suicide and homicide death, a junior representative from Arkansas named Jay Dickey passed an amendment which said that no funds could be used by the CDC for gun control advocacy. Now, of course, CDC can't use funds for advocacy anyways, but at that point, Congress took away all money that the CDC was spending on gun violence prevention research. A few years later, they did the same thing to the NIH. Since then, $0 have been appropriated to the CDC for gun violence prevention research, and NIH has spent virtually nothing, around $2 million a year for the past 10 years, versus over $500 million for opioid research last year alone. Now, the reason why this continued partisan divide exists is because people believe in this myth. And honestly, when I tell my liberal friends that I'm doing gun violence prevention research, they all go, oh, yeah, we need to ban guns. Go you advocating for gun control. But the thing is that research is not about one side or another. Any of you in the audience who do research know that it's about coming up with a good hypothesis and proving or disproving. There's a whole science of injury prevention. And what I'm trying to do with gun violence prevention research is not to advocate for one side or another, but to try to find the truth and a way forward.
One of the things that you hear in the news a lot as well is, I've got the solution. We're going to ban all the guns. Or let's just give everybody a gun. That's going to fix it too. Unfortunately, the truth is much more nuanced than that. We are a huge country with an incredibly diverse population, geography, and culture. And one solution isn't going to work. I live in a little town called Culver, Oregon. That's in the middle of Jefferson County. Jefferson County has a population of about 20,000 people. Just to give you a little bit of context, New York City has a population density of 27,000 people per square mile. Okay? I spread that, as many people as New York has as one square mile, in a county the size of Rhode Island.
What are you saying about Rhode Island?
It's an awesome place, and there's room for you out west. In Jefferson County, we have about one gun homicide a decade, maybe two if it's been a really bad decade. But my suicide rate in rural counties in Oregon is 35% higher than in cities in Oregon, in the cities. Most of that is driven by the fact that people in rural areas are more likely to attempt suicide with a gun than in urban areas. I'm also a mom. So when my son's friends come over and they're going to be playing at my house. I talk to the mom that's sending them, and I say, I have guns in my home. All of my guns are stored in the garage in a safe, except for two that are in my bedroom, which are in a different safe. Your child cannot get to any of my guns. That opens a space to create a conversation in my community about how do we keep our children safe. I talk about it to my patients that come into the emergency room. When a four-year-old's gotten into a bottle of Tylenol, I use that as a moment to talk to them about my youngest, who is Spider-Man and can get into anything. And we talk about how we safely store medications and chemicals and guns, because it's an important conversation. But I can't have that conversation without information on how we can keep our community safer.
I wish there were a vaccine against gun violence that worked for suicide and homicide. But honestly, right now in this country, I'm not sure that even if we had a vaccine, we'd be able to distribute it. Which brings us to the biggest myth of all. As I have worked on this subject over the past 5 years, one of the biggest things that I have confronted is the myth that there is no way forwards. When I sit in coffee shops or go out to dinner and talk to people about the work that I'm doing, the biggest thing that I hear is a sense of hope. I think that so many of us have given up any hope that we can change the epidemic of gun violence. And Tori and I are up here today to say that it is not time to give up. There is a path forward. It is not a short path, it is not a quick path, but it is there. And there are a few steps to it. So the first is, obviously, we need data. We can't fix anything without knowing the patterns. Even our data on firearm injuries right now is suspect. There was just a big article in The Trace about how the CDC data is not reliable. There's no way we're going to change this if we don't get better data, which allows us to do better research and show if our interventions are effective. The next thing that we need to do is we need to cross across the aisle and talk to each other. We need to do more things, like me and Tori being up here today, and talking about what that path forward looks like. I often use the analogy that trying to stop gun deaths without talking to gun owners is kind of like trying to stop motorcycle deaths while talking to a bunch of bicyclists. Right? It's not going to work. We need to talk about crime, we need to talk about suicide, we need to talk about the social determinants of health that lead people to pick up guns in the first place, and that requires a conversation. One great example of this is work done by one of my dear friends and colleagues, Emmy Betts, who's out at University of Colorado. She's created a series of courses for physicians where they become familiarized with what guns are and how they work. She also works with gun shops, and other folks across the country do this as well, to train gun shop owners in recognizing signs of suicidality among people that are going in to buy guns. This is a potential path forward.
The military has a very systematic approach to gun safety, and please know these are my opinions and do not reflect the opinions of the Department of Defense. Sorry, mandatory disclaimer. But we are the profession of arms, and this is our biggest job. We keep people safe by very carefully pre-screening and regulating who is actually allowed to have a weapon. Then you go through training and evaluation to make sure that you're safe with it. We reevaluate you, and at any time, if we decide that you're no longer safe to have that weapon, that's removed. This is a pattern that we can use and model after because it works really pretty well for the military. Another way to think about this, especially if you're not a gun native, and according to our Twitter poll, half the people in this audience have never touched a gun. If you are not, try to think about gun owners as a subculture. Remember when we were in medical school, they taught us about cultural competence and being open and being able to speak their language in a respectful way? I challenge you, if you've never touched a gun, go to a gun shop. Think about it like going to a cultural festival. You go, you eat a little of the food, you listen to the language, you see some of the rituals, and that might actually give you a perspective that will allow you to approach gun owners from an area of understanding and maybe even an area of expertise because of what you learn. And I promise you, any gun shop would be happy to help you understand a little bit more about them.
Because once we overcome these divisions, it then allows us to have the hard conversations that allow us to actually stop shooters before they shoot. Whether it be in St. Louis, I know Kristen Mueller's out in the audience, and I was down there earlier this summer doing great work with violence intervention programs, whether it's in rural Oregon or anywhere else across our country, we need to come together first. And this slide makes me a little uncomfortable that I'm talking about my own organization, but I do want to kind of mention Affirm. So this is a 501c3 that was started last year by myself and a fellow emergency physician who's a gun owner in Vermont. And we created this because we were tired of waiting for someone else to do something. I know yesterday one of the speakers talked about that if there's a problem that no one else is fixing, you need to stand up and fix it, and that's what we're doing. We're creating private-public partnerships in order to fund the gun violence research that has not been done by our country for the past 20-odd years. We are nonpartisan, we are not Republican or Democrat, we are not gun owners or non-gun owners. What we are for is science.
I love Megan's work because one of the things that I firmly believe is whether you're a gun owner or a physician, we cannot be afraid of data and seeing where it leads us. Unfortunately, the politicians can't figure this out. They can't do research without turning it into a political tool. So this is our opportunity today to start making an impact on this problem. If you check your Twitter feed, Megan wouldn't do this, so I'm doing it. There's a link to Affirm. Please send them some money so that we can start doing this research and start getting this information so that I can talk to people from an area that we actually have some data from.
So this, of course, is a picture of Joan of Arc. And we worked with our coaches as we were preparing this talk to try to find a picture of a strong woman who battled myths and slayed dragons and lived. There are very few such stories out there. I do, however, believe that enough Americans have already been martyred to gun violence to make up for both of us. And so my hope is that through this talk and through all of us in this audience going out and spreading the message of a different way forwards, we can end the epidemic of American gun violence together. Thank you.
That was awesome. Oh.